Our guest is a man whose name is very familiar to radio listeners and whose voice is even more familiar. He's Les Tremaine, and we're happy to have this chance to chat with you. Welcome.
Thank you very much, Chuck. It's nice to be here.
You recognize that voice now, didn't you? Let's match the voice to the identity for a moment.
Can I clear up a point right now?
Go right ahead.
So many people these days say, oh, you were Mr. First Nighter. Mm-hmm. That's not quite true. It's like Dr. Frankenstein and the Monster, or who else? Well, we'll think of somebody else. But I was never Mr. First Nighter, who was the host of the program. Uh-huh. I was the romantic leading man. Even with my snowy beard now, I was the guy who always got the girl. But for some reason, I guess it's more convenient for people to say Mr. First Nighter.
Well, it's very difficult to say that you were the leading man on the First Nighter.
Yeah.
Because it's a mouthful, for one thing. Mm-hmm. And secondly, you were in a different role every week. It was romantic comedy most of the time. With the exception of
The Christmas show, which was always about Mary and Joseph, and so. You met one of the Mr. First Nighters today, Brett Morrison's manager.
Yes.
Who was also the Shadow. Uh-huh. Little plug.
Well, when were you on the First Nighter?
I was on the show from about 1932 on. Mm-hmm. I became the leading man in 1937. And I left the show the middle of 1943. Prior to that, I had been the leading man for, 2 years, I guess, on Campana's other half-hour dramatic show, which was on Sunday afternoons on NBC, called Grand Hotel. And they had, leased the title, or whatever you wish to call it, from the property, you know, the Grand Hotel film. Mm-hmm. And I did that with Ann Seymour for, I don't know, 2 or 3 years. Ann is out here in Hollywood and works, you know, constantly. As I say, I left the show in 1943, but every actor needs an ID point, an identification mm-hmm. point. Mm-hmm. And usually one specific thing that occurs in your career through the years will be that ID point. And for me, it was the First Nighter. It's really the luckiest, most fortunate thing I ever did in show business. And I've been in it since I was 3.5 years old.
Did you play the First Nighter on the First Nighter mm-hmm. Totally in Chicago, or did you move with it?
No, always in Chicago uh-huh. when I did it. Uh-huh. And incidentally, it was never in New York.
Never in New York.
People sometimes, of course, think it was because of the subtitle, The Little Theater uh-huh. off Times mm-hmm. Square. But that, of course, was part of the illusion of radio, you know.
You played often, opposite Barbara Luddy
always.
On that show. Did you ever play with any of the other leading ladies?
I did, but not as the leading man. I played mm-hmm. on the show with June Meredith and, I believe, Betty Lou Gerson. Mm-hmm. And I think those were the only two before Barbara came on. Barbara had the longest tenure, shall we say. She was on the show from about 1936 till what? It went off in the middle 50s, I mm-hmm, think. Mm-hmm. By then it had moved to Hollywood for the second time.
For the second time?
Mm-hmm. It came out here in 1936 from Chicago, when Don Ameche, who was the second leading man on the show, came out to go into pictures. And, of course, almost immediately his agent, as I understand the story, asked for a lot more money, because at that time he was a very hot property. And Campana had a budget beyond which they couldn't extend themselves, so they started looking around for a leading man. And I know, it's kind of a cute story. I've never told it until recently. I told it at the PPB luncheon on the 16th of November when I produced and hosted the First Nighter Day. And
now
had a lot of the people on it. That's the Pacific Pioneer Broadcasters. It's a group of people out here, all of whom have been in broadcasting for at least 20 years, radio, mm-hmm. 15 years television. The story I told was how I became the leading man on the First Nighter, even though I was, and I must be specific about this, the leading man already for 2 years on the Grand Hotel show. Mm-hmm. When Don left the show, Campana started looking coast to coast for an actor to play the leads, and they auditioned theater people, radio people, oh my golly, from coast to coast, movie stars, and they couldn't find anybody they wanted. Well, I knew what they wanted because I had worked with Don on three different shows, Betty and Bob, Grand Hotel, and Jack Armstrong, four different shows, and First Nighter. And it occurred to me that what they wanted was Don Ameche. It's very simple.
Mm-hmm.
Well, our voices weren't dissimilar, and I knew his work so well. So I went down to RCA, and I talked to dear Betty Mitchell, who is now gone, a young lady who was the hungry actor's best friend, you know. And I said, Betty, I'd like to listen to some tapes of Don Ameche. And she said, or rather, discs.
Uh-huh.
We didn't have tape in those days. Of Don Ameche. And she said, okay, honey, what for? You've worked together so much. What do you want to hear him for? And I told her. She said, okay. And she gave me a studio and sat me down with a bunch of 16-inch discs and let me listen to them. Then I immediately went up to the 19th floor of NBC and auditioned for Campana, because I had gone to them and said, look, I'm the leading man on your other show. Why don't you at least give me a chance to read for you? And they said, well, we never thought of it, sort of thing, you know? So I read for it, and I played Don Ameche. Pure and simple. I even did his laugh, a sort of a strange laugh he had, you know? And that's how I became the leading man. They said, that's it. And they didn't know what I was doing. It never occurred to them. And over a period of about 4 weeks after I started on the show, I weaned away from Don's delivery and became myself, you know. It's kind of a cute story.
Sure. That was an interesting thing, too, because I would have thought that maybe they would like to have had different stars coming in instead of a resident leading man and leading lady.
Yeah, well, that happened, as I understand it. I left Chicago, you see, in 43. But when I left the show, Barbara and I had become so popular and so firmly ensconced on the show that they couldn't find somebody to replace me. See, history repeats itself. So they rotated four different leading men who were pretty well-known people around Chicago. And I forget the names of several of them. And finally, they decided on Olin Soule, who then became the leading man for, I don't know, 8-9 years, until the show went off the air. And, of course, I'd known Ole for years and years and years.
Some familiar names. It's really exciting for me to talk in person with people whose names and whose voices have entertained me on the radio years ago.
Well, you must have been a little boy.
I was a little guy. Well, yeah. Not so little.
Do you remember Jack Armstrong?
Oh, sure. Mm. Well, Don Ameche. I'd never heard Don Ameche as Jim Ameche.
Jim Ameche was Jack Armstrong, and Don was on the show. He was hot around Chicago in those days, the early 30s, middle 30s. And he played Captain Hughes. And when he played Captain Hughes, opposite Jim Ameche, who was playing Jack Armstrong, nobody knew who the heck was playing who, you see. So they had to replace him, and that was the first replacement of Don that I was part of. And I didn't realize that. I didn't remember that until Jim Ameche, who is a good friend of mine, told me so about a year ago. He says, you know, no, it wasn't three shows, it was four shows. And he reminded me of this. And then I was George Hartford, Bob Drake's bosom buddy on Betty and Bob. And when Don left that show, I became Bob. Then, as I said, Grand Hotel and First Nighter.
First Nighter was so popular that a couple of other programs, fairly good imitations, occurred.
Mm-hmm.
Curtain Time was one of them, and the Knickerbocker Playhouse.
Central Station, which was not a theater format, but much the same type of thing, the structure of the show.
That's right. You know, I never thought about Grand Central Station in that same light, but
they had a framework.
Yeah,
as we did theater, they had, you know, Grand Central Station.
Yeah.
And then their drama unfolded from that framework. Yeah.
That was always a New York
show,
wasn't it?
Mm-hmm.
When did you first come into Chicago? When did you get
I started in radio on my birthday, April 16th, in 1931. I had been there for a number of years before that, playing vaudeville and carnivals and amusement parks and community theater, little theater, stock, tent shows, everything. And I started in England, where I was born. I was born in London. And my mother was an actress. And God bless her, still is, as a matter of fact. And she was in motion pictures there. And my brother and I worked with her when I was 3.5 years old. We came over here shortly after that, 4.5. And had our English accents beaten out of us by the kids on the west side of Chicago going to school, you know. So I've been in it a long time. I'm 60 years old now, and I've been in it for 57 years. Long time.
What, talk about growing up in Chicago. Where did you go to high school?
I never finished high school. I had to quit and go to work.
Uh-huh.
We were pretty poor when we got to this country. It's strange. Anyway, went to Lakeview High.
Edgar Bergen's...
That's right. I was just going to say to you, I do much the same sort of thing for the PPB, the Pacific Pioneer Broadcasters, and Edgar Bergen is our chairman of the board, and I interviewed him not long ago. I'm what they call their audio history chairman. And when Ed said, I said, where'd you go to school? And he says, well, I went to Lakeview High, and we flipped, because he had preceded me, I guess, by about 8-10 years.
Mm-hmm.
But so we didn't know each other in school. But school, I was an honor student, and I won scholarships, and I was never allowed to skip grades.
Mm-hmm.
And that I'm thankful for, because I think you miss too much. But the scholarship I was not allowed to accept. My father was a tough man, God rest his soul, but he was a tough man, and he didn't believe in the theater, and he didn't want my mother to be in it, and he didn't want me to be in it, you know. And I won it for my singing abilities, and that kind of put a crimp in me for a while, and I never sang. And I have been singing recently, and I used to sing on First Night or now and then, and people are always amazed to find that I can sing, you know. Strange little thing.
I didn't know that you had sung on First Nighter. Did they often do things with music?
Not too often. Now and then I played, that I happen to have a recording of was a young romantic Mexican millionaire's son, and he also sang. He sang under Barbara Luddy's window with a guitar, you know, that sort of thing.
You were on the Chicago Theater of the Air from time to time.
Yeah.
You ever sing on that, or did you just do the story?
No, just the dramatic portions, yeah.
We got off the track a second ago. What was your first radio job in Chicago? Was it in Chicago?
Yes. The first show I ever did was on WCFL, the labor station there. It was called The Night Court. It was a show with three men and a woman were the regulars on the show. They had built this show. And in 1931, you know, just about anything went.
Mm-hmm.
And one played the judge, and the other one was it was two men and a woman. One was the defense attorney, and the other was the prosecuting attorney. And then people like myself came in and played, in those days we had no minority stereotypes, so you played the Italian, the Japanese, whatever, you know, with heavy dialects. And it was a comedy show. It was sort of a traffic court thing. And that was the first show I ever did. There were many other shows. Oh, gosh, they piled up so fast.
You did a lot of soap operas.
I was the original leading man on Helen Trent.
Gil Whitney?
No, Grant Douglas. Before Gil Whitney came
on
the show. On the audition. I helped sell the show June or July of 1934. Anne Ashenhurst came up from New York. Later, Anne Hummert, wife of Frank Hummert of Blackett, Sample, and Hummert, which later became Dancer Fitzgerald and Sample, an advertising agency. And she came out to cast the show, and we made a live audition, which I guess was piped back to New York or wherever for the sponsors. And Virginia Clark was Helen Trent, and I'll never forget it. I'm this dashing leading man, and I come down the hall in this, apartment building, hotel, whatever, and I hear this lovely voice. Virginia sang, too, and she was singing, and it arrested me, you know, and I came up to the door, and I listened to her sing, and then I sang back to her through the door, you see. And I was on the show for a year or so, but that's so long ago, nobody remembers it, you know.
Well, you were on a few other soaps in town. I guess anybody who was on a soap opera was on a lot of soap operas.
Yes. People used to say who were trying to get into the business and couldn't make it for one reason or another, they used to say it was a closed thing, it was a click. Well, it wasn't that, but if you had the sometimes peculiar capabilities which made you a good radio actor, you were used a lot because it was a matter of time more than anything else, and time is money. And if they knew that they could call you and you could do any number of voices, you know, they would rather use you than take a chance on somebody new. It's still the same thing today, you know. And, you know, radio stands me in good stead today because I do a great deal of voice work. As a matter of fact, I have a special on this Friday night, the cricket in Times Square.
We did one last year. You're back in Times Square again, then.
Yes, that's right. We're doing Very Merry Cricket on ABC, and I play the cricket and Harry the cat and, assorted voices and Professor Smedley I don't know. I can't remember them all. I sing in that, incidentally, but kind of corny singing, you know, for Harry the Cat, who is a rather Ronald Coleman-ish type.
Do you do many voices? From this, I mean, in your radio work today, the voiceovers,
yes.
You do a lot?
Well, you see, there isn't much radio left. There's one radio show extant in Hollywood, and that is called Heartbeat Theater. Mm-hmm. And it's a half-hour show.
Salvation Army thing.
For the Salvation Army, very early in the morning on Sundays, like 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning. But we tape it, of course, prior to that. That's the only radio show around now, but I do a lot of animated voices. I do children's books, golden books, that sort of thing. I do many training films and documentaries, and I'm the spokesman for a home loan company here, an on-camera spokesman, corporate image, you know. That's why I have to shave this beard when I do that later on, right after Christmas.
The beard is for a movie you're doing.
Yes, I'm starred in a theatrical motion picture, not for television, which is all shot now except for pickup shots or added scenes or retakes of something that went bad. We had a bad camera for a while. It's called Holy Wednesday. That's the working title. And it is the story of an old goat who lives out in the Texas desert, right close to a little town of 600 people, and he collects snakes for the University of Chicago. While he has the snakes, he has, maybe 100 of them crawling around on this old dilapidated ranch where he lives due to the good graces of his buddy, with whom he plays and listens to Sousa's band marches every Wednesday night. And if anybody in the town does him dirt, well, he simply kills him with a rattlesnake or a water moccasin or something, and makes no bones about it. But he is still the hero, and he's a sympathetic character, and there's no moral retribution at the end of the picture. He simply rolls them off a cliff in their own cars, and they get hidden down below in the brush.
Holy Wednesday.
They probably will change the title. It might be Unholy Wednesday, or it might be, I don't know, Snakey's Wednesday Night, for all I know.
Who co-stars with you in it?
There's a young lady, Janet Wood, who is the young co-star. There's another girl, B.B. Kelly, very fine little actress who has to work with the snakes great deal. Marvin Kaplan, who used to be on the TV show Meet Millie years ago.
Uh-huh.
Marv is in it. And Dick Kennedy, very fine youngish actor, youngish, I guess, in his 40s, you know, big, strapping Irishman and a fine actor. It was great fun playing scenes with him. We had one scene that was 8 minutes long, which is long for a motion picture take. And we did it once, and I never shut my mouth. It was a long scene, and we did it in a closed room in someone's home in Beaumont, California, where we shot the whole picture. And all the windows were closed. There was no air conditioning. And with all those hot lights, it must have been about 120 in the room. And it was an active scene. We were marching to the band music, you know, and jumping around and rolling on the floor and talking all the time loud because the music is on. And Dick, he did a fine job and was great. in the interplay with me, and it worked out beautifully. As a matter of fact, it brought applause, which is kind of nice. I sound like I'm bragging, but it's nice to hear.
From the crew, you mean?
From the crew, and later on when a bunch of people from MGM saw it out at the Air Force Base near San Bernardino. I can't remember the name of the Air Force Base. Isn't that silly? Anyway, Norton, I think it is. They stood up and applauded after they saw this particular scene. They were running rough cuts, dailies.
Well, that's nice.
Yeah, it's kind of nice to have that experience. But it was one of the most exhilarating things that's happened to me in years, truly, this picture. They were wonderful to me. It's produced by two men who had never produced a film before, Art Names and John Wilson, and directed by Art Names, and the two boys wrote it. And I don't know who's scoring it. I forget offhand. It's being edited at the moment.
Will it be released by MGM?
No, I don't think so. There were some people at Norton that day, and they happened to see it. They were in the business, and I figured if they laughed and applauded that much, it must be a pretty good scene, because they know the business, you know. We don't know who's going to release it yet, but it will be probably March or April of 74 before it's ready.
We're going to look for it.
Thank you. I hope so.
What have you done on television? Oh, you must have done loads and loads of acting chores.
I started in television in Chicago in 1939 on W9XYZ, Zenith Experimental Station.
1939.
Mm-hmm.
You weren't playing a test pattern or anything at that time?
No, as a matter of fact, I was hosting and playing the leading man on a series of 45-minute dramatic shows. And if I may say so, this was pure hell. There was no air conditioning. It was a very small room, maybe twice the size of this room we're in. And it must have been 140 degrees. I was a thin young man, and I lost 8 pounds on the first show. I had to host the thing in tails, and then, with no incidental music, no way to segue out of one scene into another, I hosted the thing and crawled out of one scene, undressing and getting into a business suit from tails, and came right into the scene as the lead in the show, you know. Well, 45 minutes of that, boy, and I'm telling you, I was worn to a frazzle, and this went on for a few weeks, and that was enough of that.
It must have been one of the very first dramatic things ever on television, period, let alone Chicago.
I suppose. I really don't know, but 39 was pretty young for television.
Chicago and Zenith never got together as far as television is concerned.
Is that so?
No, there was never... Zenith was trying to do a little bit with the Phonovision thing there back in the early 50s, but they just it never got off the ground, and we never did get a Zenith-owned TV station.
I'll be. You never heard of W9XYZ?
I don't remember. That was an experimental call letter thing. You know. Yeah. The first two TV stations Chicago had were WBKB. It was owned by Balbin and Katz Corporation. Then WGN-TV. Which, you know, was owned by the Tribune and all that sort of thing.
WGN, World's Greatest Newspaper.
Right. All the call letters, well, when we go into that, we'd be on forever with that, what the call letters stood for. You were, you know, we talk about the first nighter and your identification with that program, but there was another program that you were rather well identified with.
Thin Man?
In my mind, that's exactly right, the Thin Man. You and Claudia Morgan.
Claudia Morgan, lovely girl. And I should say Barbara Luddy is also not only a fine actress, but one of the most unique and delightful voices in all of radio. And she's still around. I saw her, you know, a few weeks ago at the PPB thing. Claudia Morgan, the daughter of Ralph Morgan, the famous theater and motion picture actor, and niece of Frank Morgan, even more famous. Yeah, I did Thin Man for about 5 years. I did The Falcon for, I don't know, 3-4 years. And just about every other show that was ever on the boards, I co-starred with various people on several Lux radio theaters. And incidentally, in those years, the middle 30s, middle and late 30s, first nighter with a very small budget, actually.
Mm-hmm.
And we had 2 hours rehearsal on that show, including the music rehearsal. And it was a full network. We played to, 25, 30 million people, which was a tremendous audience in those days. We were neck and neck with Lux Radio Theater for years. They would be top in the polls, or we would be top. And we alternated back and forth. And they had a tremendous budget. They had to have with all those movie stars, you know, who were guesting on their show. And I don't know, we had ratings up in 27, 28, 27.6, you know. And Barbara and I were voted as the top dramatic actor and actress in America, you know, that sort of thing. It was beautiful times, beautiful.
It was always a good show. It was always a good show. Where did the scripts come from for First Nighter?
The freelance market.
The freelance market.
Always.
And anyone who wanted to write could submit a script.
And they had a special formula, and they had a moral code, a very strict moral code. You didn't say God or damn or darn or heck or anything like that. The leading lady and leading man did not smoke or drink, no gambling, you know, a very circumspect sort of formula, moral code, you might say. The shows were submitted by people. They were submitted to a sort of a jury of people consisting of a lady novelist, Florence Ward, God bless her. She was a lovely woman. And Bill Krull, who at that time was the vice president and nephew of Emo Oswald, who was the president and founder of Campana, which is now part of the Purex Corporation. Bill Krull is now the president of Campana. I spoke to him just a couple of weeks ago. The panel was made up of the director, Bill Krull, Florence Ward, and I don't know, maybe one or two other people. Oh, Tom Wallace, God bless him, wonderful man, who was the head of Aubrey Moore and Wallace Advertising Agency, who had the account. And later Wallace, Ferry, and Hanley in Chicago, in case you're familiar with them. Tom is gone now, Emo is gone, Florence Ward, I think, is gone. I guess I shouldn't dwell on that stuff. Anyway, they would set up a music stand in the studio, and they would call Barbara and myself and whatever character people who worked the show more or less regularly, and they'd call them in for one of these readings, and we would read 6, 8, 10, 12 scripts in a morning or an afternoon, all grouped around this one microphone with the one script, and it was cold. Nobody knew what he was doing until he did it, you know. We had to give a performance as much as we could so that they could get a feel for the show, you know. Then, after that, and it was great training, tremendous training, even though we'd been in it a long time, it made you so facile as far as sight reading is concerned. And beautiful characterizations from our character people, Forrest Lewis, Phil Lord, Cliff Sabir, oh, they go on and on, Shirley Mitchell. Anyway, we would read the scripts. They would make notes in the control room. Then if they needed fixing, they'd send them back. Or possibly Florence Ward would do some fixing, you know, because she was... she was, I think, employed by Campana in this capacity. So no one person wrote the show. Anybody who had something to submit did so. Addison Simmons was one of our more or less regulars. Virginia Safford Lynn wrote a lot of them. Oh, many, many people. I can't remember their names now.
Were they, you mentioned that they were freelancers, but they were professional.
Oh, yes. Yes, definitely. Very definitely. Well, some of them were just starting out, perhaps, you know, but they were professional writers. As long as we're on First Nighter, I'd like to mention a couple of other things. Francis X. Bushman at one time, the famous theater and motion picture idol, was Mr. First Nighter. The show was originated and created by a man named Charlie P. Hughes, who was the original Mr. First Nighter and used to be wheeled out. They wheeled out a beautiful gold and red plush theater box onto the onto the studio floor, and then Charlie would come out in white tie and tails and a top hat and his stick and would sit in the box with a microphone and introduce the show. And Charlie's lady friend was June Meredith. And she was the original leading lady.
Uh-huh.
The original leading man was a dear friend of mine, Jack Doty. Very few people remember him. He died in 1935 at the age of 35. And I was with him when he died. It was a very tragic death. But he had a drinking problem, mm-hmm. frankly. And I am not saying this in a derogatory way at all, because I loved the man. And I used to try and find him when he disappeared for mm-hmm. weeks or months mm-hmm. on end, you know, and we'd find him in a flea bag in Clark Street or something like that. And when he disappeared, all of his roles had to be recast in the various shows he was doing, mm-hmm. in the soap mm-hmm. operas and First Nighter and so on. And he was really a ladies man. He had this, he was a tremendous actor, truly, and had this gorgeous deep voice, beautiful romantic voice. And he had beautiful gray eyes, and he was not a pretty man. Matter of fact, he was rather thin and emaciated, with thinning, graying hair. But there was a charm about him. And the day they found him, or I found him, and would bring him back to the studio, shaking like an aspen leaf and uh-huh. a slight shade of green, he would have all his shows back. Every one of them came back to him. Because he was so unique and such uh-huh. a fine actor. The women loved him. Jack Doty, fine man. Had a very tragic life, mm. you know.
That's sad. Yeah. Two names come to my mind as associated with the First Nighter program. Mm. Rye Bilsberry.
Mm-hmm. Now known as Mike Rye.
He's Mike Rye now.
Yes, huh? Yes. He was Mr. First Nighter for a while, uh-huh. I believe, in Chicago. And he was also a Jack Armstrong after Jim Amici mm. left it for mm. a while. Mm-hmm. The other Mike's a good friend of mine. He's here in town.
Say hello.
I will, indeed. Sure.
The other name is Eric Sagerquist.
Oh, God bless him. He's long gone now, but he was the original conductor and arranger and musikmeister mm-hmm. of the First Nighter Orchestra, Pitt Orchestra. Yes.
There was a very special sound to the theme of the First Nighter program,
yeah.
and I guess it was the use of violins more than
yeah.
anything.
It was the instrumentation, uh-huh. actually, uh-huh. to make it sound as much like a pit orchestra
yeah.
as possible.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. I always used to associate the sound of the theme of the... Because when I was listening to the First Nighter as a youngster in the 40s, I never got to the legitimate theater to see the shows or things.
Sure.
But this was great, because the imagination and you guys
yes.
and the sound men and the music, they
yes.
took me there.
Yeah.
But the only sound that I found was close to the First Nighter theme was Ralph Ginsberg from the Drake Hotel, I think.
Yeah, the Palmer House.
Palmer House. Yeah.
The Empire Room of the Palmer House.
Yeah.
My golly, yes. Yes, yes, yes. Yeah, the string quartet or something like
yeah.
that. You know? Mm-hmm. You know, radio was a wonderful medium. It's a shame that radio drama is what I'm speaking of. It's a shame that it's gone. It did something for actors, and I have said this many times, that has never been done before or since in all of history for the journeyman actor, the lay actor. And that is, it made him an upstanding, homeowning, stay-in-one-place, family-raising, tax-paying, bill-paying, credit, possible credit. What am I trying to say? He was able to have a credit rating.
Mm-hmm.
It did all these things for actors who were not big stars. And you had a steady salary, and you became famous, and people loved you, and you had people named their children after you. My gosh, I must have, I don't know, 50, 60, 70 kids named after me. Kids,
yeah.
They're now 30 years old, you know, in the United States. And they became so familiar with your voice. It was a great ID point for me in the theater in New York, mm-hmm. and also when I went into pictures in Hollywood, because people didn't know my face particularly, but as soon as they heard the voice, they knew who it was. And it was a great tie-in for me. Even today, people over 35 remember me and are familiar with my voice. Telephone operators.
Just at random, you pick up
yeah.
the phone and make a
yeah.
call and they say, I know their voice?
Mm-hmm. Are you, what was that show you were on? You know, a lot of older ladies, you know, middle-aged ladies or telephone operators, and they know voices. Traveling around the country, you sign your name on a credit card in a gas station or something, and they remember you. And you have friends everywhere. It's beautiful, not only as an entree to a lot of things, but just the fact that there is a warm feeling in the recollections of the things you did and they heard you do. And as you said, your imagination created everything. You were actively with us. Mm-hmm. You weren't stupefied looking at a big eye. And well, I'm sorry to say that's what television is.
We were participants.
Right, right.
And well, now there is some little bit of new time radio coming around.
Yeah.
There's a Hollywood Radio Theater being produced out here, which has been running for a little while, picked up by Mutual. Have you been on any of those shows?
I was on the first one.
The Life of
Radio
the Red-Haired
Theater.
Man, I think.
Yes.
Yeah.
I was the husband. Mm-hmm. And it was just a two-page part, but I wanted to do it, and I told Jay Kolos, who was the head of the organization that produced these things, and Elliot Lewis was the director, he's an old friend and a former radio actor. I told them, please, yes, call me, I will do anything. So they did, and that was a two-page part.
Well, you know, it's interesting. Our station is carrying the Zero Hour series.
Oh, yes.
And the formula for casting is kind of obvious. The leads are from television today.
Television or pictures.
Or movies, right. But the supporting cast are all the names from radio, the working actors and actresses who knew how to do it.
Or and former radio stars, you see.
Well, that's right. But they give the credits at the end of the show, and it's amazing.
It's a real
15
roster.
15 different names.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, if you listen carefully... Now, if you like radio and you really respect the people and everything, you can listen to these shows and you can really tell the pros who have the radio background, because the supporting casts are usually superb. And then some of the people who come in from TV or the movies, you can kind of, you know, you're not supposed to visualize a guy standing there with a script, right?
Right. Well, I can see you loved radio and still do. And I thank you for saying that. I didn't want to say it, but it's true. And that same situation persisted in radio in the old days, too. They always had the feeling that to sell a show or to get an audience, you had to have a movie star or more.
Mm-hmm.
And many is the time, at the last minute, I have been called to do heavy dramas like Crime and Punishment and Attorney at Law, Counselor at Law, Night of January 16th. Which was a heavy part. Sure, you read them. And I would do them practically cold on the network on a live show because a movie star broke down and either came in drunk or was so afraid of the microphone he couldn't do it. Or I was called, not only myself, a lot of us, called in to play a lead opposite a movie star who was pretty bad and had to have someone to support her and really support her, hold her up. And I think it's part of show business, but it's a crime, truly, because radio people in their own medium do not need movie stars to hold up a show. They do a pretty good job of it themselves, you know. And actually, the movie people and some of the TV people who had no radio training are a deterrent. They hurt the quality of a broadcast. But... as I say, they figure that this is the way to get an audience. And I'm sorry. The radio audience is so loyal to the radio people they fell in love with 10, 20, 30 years ago or more. They don't want movie stars. They want to hear their radio people. Yeah. They want to hear Lorenzo Jones or Virginia Clark, Helen Trent, or any number of people, you know. You met Ed Prentice today.
Yes.
Ed
yeah.
was one of the Mr. First Nighters at one time. Mm-hmm. And I believe played some of the leads after I left the show. I'm not sure. Will Waterman, who later was Gildersleeve after Hal Perry left the show, he used to work the show all the time. As a matter of fact, he sent me a note the other day, and he says, I think I have a rare distinction. He says, I'm the only actor who ever played every part on the Christmas show we used to do except Mary. And he has a big, deep voice.
Those were good days, and you contributed an awful lot to him.
Well, it did a lot for us, too. I mean, there was a great deal of reciprocity there, although we didn't think of it that way. We were having a ball. We were the busiest people in the world. For 2 solid years in Chicago, I did 45 shows a week, every week. And that's a lot of shows, believe me. Almost 7 a day. And
that was including repeat broadcasts.
Yes.
Something.
Mm-hmm.
There was the first nighter ever, was that on a repeat basis? Did you have to do that twice? It was on Sundays for a long while, wasn't it?
I really can't remember, but I don't think the first nighter was. We were on at 9 o'clock as a rule. Mm-hmm. And that was a pretty good time, coast to coast. Thin Man, yes.
Mm-hmm.
Inner Sanctum. Most of the shows from the East had to have a repeat for the West Coast. And a lot of those, Fu Manchu, I believe we used to do. That's very early.
Mm-hmm.
That was my first commercial show, a sponsored show. And I had to ask my producer-director at WCFL, that was in 31, the difference between a sustaining and a commercial show. I didn't know.
You could tell by the paycheck size, couldn't you?
Well, there wasn't much difference in those days. I did my first, as I said, sponsored network show was Fu Manchu, and that was a big deal. Oh, boy, that was the biggest show around. It had just gone on. And I'll never forget, I played a young Jewish art shopkeeper who was poisoned by the golden needles in the golden pomegranates in this beautiful carved box. And I don't know whether I was trying to steal it or what, but I got my fingers caught in the pomegranates and it killed me, and I screamed, and oh, it was a great death scene. But it was a big deal, and coast to coast, and Bob White, Charlie Warburton, and Jack Daly was Fu Manchu, and Dr. Petrie was Bob White, and Charlie Warburton was Inspector, Smith, Renee Smith, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, they were the three leads, and a girl named Sunda Love was on it as a Chinese character. I forget, Fu Manchu's daughter or something like that. You had to dress on that show. That was my first dress show. Up to that time, I had not made any money in radio. I was in it for 8 months before I made a cent, and then I started making $2 a show or $1.50 a show, something like that. And I made $15 on Fu Manchu with a repeat. But, now this is a long time ago, I had to buy a tux. And a tux means shoes and socks and a shirt and a bow tie. The whole works, you know. Cufflinks. And I don't know how I did it. I was never a scrounger. I didn't know how to do those things. I wasn't a con man. But somehow I got this outfit for $15. So I didn't make anything on the show. You know, because I was very poor in those days. I remember when 15 cents was a heck of a lot of money. Yeah. I was studying sculpture, and I needed some sculpting tools. And I went to the art store and took one look at him in the window, and it said 15 cents, and I gave up. I made my own, you know.
Well, I'm glad that you sculptured yourself a career in radio. And I appreciate very much your taking some time with us today to chat about
Wouldn't have missed it, Chuck. Thank you very much, and God bless all those people who still listen to us.
Thank you. Les Tremaine.